He had gone into the room. Mr. and Mrs. Ross were there, sitting in red vinyl chairs. Brian was in the bed by the window, surrounded by equipment that beeped and sent green lines rolling across video screens. A light blanket was pulled up to his waist. Above it, a thin white hospital shirt lay open like cheesy school play angel's wings on either side of his chest. There were all sorts of burst suckers on him down there, and more attached to his head, below a vast white cap of bandage. From beneath cap, one long cut descended Brian's left cheek to the corner of his mouth, where it curved up like a fish hook. The cut had been sutured with black thread. To David, it had looked like something out of a Frankenstein movie, one of the old ones with Boris Karloff they put on Saturday nights. Sometimes when he slept over at Brian's, the two of them stayed up and ate popcorn and watched those movies. Once during The Mummy, Brian had turned to David and said, "Oh, shit, the mummy's after us. Let's all walk a little faster." Stupid, but at 1:45 in the morning, anything can strike 11-year-olds funny, and the two of them had laughed like fiends. Brian's eyes had looked up at him from the hospital bed and through him. They were open and as empty as school classrooms in August. Feeling more than ever as if he were not moving but being moved, David had walked into the magic circle of the machines. David thought, these are the machines that are keeping him alive, and when they turn them off, when they pull out the needles, disbelief filled him at the idea. Buds of wonder, which were only grief, rolled tight. He and Brian squirted each other at the water fountain outside their homeroom at school whenever they thought they could get away with it. They rode their bikes in their street woods, pretending they were commandos. They slapped each other high fives and called each other bad boy. In the second grade, they'd pricked their fingers with pins and smooshed them together and sworn themselves blood brothers. In August of this year, they had made, with Harry Ross's help, a bottle cap Parthenon from a picture in a book. It was the Parthenon that David's mind had fixed upon most firmly as he stood by his comatose friend's bed. They had built it, him, Brian, Brian's dad, out in the Ross garage, while the tape player endlessly recycled Rattle and Hum on the shelf behind them. A silly thing because it was just bottle caps. A cool thing because it looked like what it was supposed to look like. You could tell what it was. Also a cool thing because they had made it with their own hands. And soon, Brian's hands would be picked up and scrubbed by an undertaker who would use a special brush and pay particular attention to the fingernails. And after Bri's hands were clean and he was in the coffin, the undertaker would lace his fingers together like they were a pair of sneakers. And that was how they'd stay, down in the ground, neatly folded, the way they had been supposed to fold their hands on their desks back in the second grade. No more bottle cap buildings for those hands. No more water fountain nozzles for those fingers. Down into the dark with them. It was not terror this thought had called up in his mind and heart, but despair, as if the image of Brian's fingers laced together in his coffin proved that nothing was worth anything, that doing never once in the world stopped dying, that not even kids were exempted from the horror show that roared on and on behind the peppermint sitcom facade your parents believed in and wanted you to believe in. David had taken his friend's hand. It was astoundingly cool and lax in his own, but still alive. You could feel the life in it, running like a motor. He squeezed it gently and whispered, "How you doing, bad boy?" No response, but the sound of the machine that was doing Brian's breathing for him now that his brain had blown most of its fuses. The sound this machine made was quiet, but the accordion thing was unsettling just the same. It made a low, emphatic noise each time it went up, a gasping noise. It was as if part of Brian wasn't down too deep to feel pain, but that part had been taken out of his body and penned up in the plastic tube where it was now being hurt even worse, where it was being pressed to death by the white accordion thing. And then there were the eyes. David felt his eyes drawn back to them again and again. Nobody had told him Brian's eyes would be open. Until just now, he hadn't known your eyes could be open when you were unconscious. One of Brian's eyes was bloodshot, with a huge black pupil that ate up all but the thinnest ring of brown. The other was clear, and the pupil appeared to be normal, but nothing else was normal. because there was no sign of his friend in those eyes. None. It was the nothing that drew him. The absence. The goneness in those eyes. It was more than wrong. It was evil. A voice deep in his head whispered. It was like no voice he had ever heard in his thoughts before. A total stranger. And when Debbie Ross's hand dropped on his shoulder, he'd had to clamp his lips together against a scream. "The man who did it was drunk," she said in a husky, tear-clotted voice. "He says he doesn't remember any of it. He was in a blackout. And do you know the horrible thing, baby? I believe him."
"Deb," Mr. Ross began, but Brian's mom took no notice of him.
"How could God let that man not remember hitting my son with his car?"
Her voice had begun to rise. Ralph Carver had poked his head around the edge of the open door, startled, and a nurse rolling a cart up the hall stopped dead in her tracks.
"How could God be so merciful to someone who deserves to wake up screaming with memories of the blood coming out of my son's poor hurt head every night for the rest of his life?"
Mr. Ross put his arm around her shoulders. Outside the door, Ralph Carver drew his head back like a turtle drawing into its shell. David saw this and might have hated his dad a little for it. He couldn't remember for sure, one way or the other. What he remembered was looking down at Brian's pale, still face, with the misshapen bandage seeming to bear down on it, the waxy ear, the horrible cut with its red lips drawn together in a smooch by the black thread, and the eyes. Most of all, what he remembered was the eyes. Brian's mother was right there, crying and screaming, and those eyes didn't change a bit. Brian, harking to his mother's sermon with a waxy ear, not noticing, not here, but, "Yes," something whispered. "Yes, he is. He is somewhere."
"Nurse, can you give my wife a shot?" Mr. Ross had asked.
"I'll get Dr. Burgoyne. He's just up the hall."
She hurried out. Brian's dad gave David a strained smile. There was sweat trickling down his cheeks and standing out on his forehead in a galaxy of fine dots.
"You have to go now, David," Mr. Ross said. We're not so good."
"But I didn't say goodbye to him," David wanted to say, and then realized it wasn't sweat trickling down Mr. Ross's cheeks, but tears. That got him moving. It wasn't until he got to the door and turned back and saw Mr. and Mrs. Ross had blurred into a whole crowd of parents that he realized he was shortly going to be crying himself.
"May I come back, Mr. Ross?" he asked in a cracked, wavering voice he barely recognized. "Tomorrow, maybe?"
Mr. Ross was shaking his head.
"I don't think so, Davy."
"But..."
"No, I don't think so. You see, the doctors say there's no chance at all for Brian to...
His face began to change as David had never seen an adult's face change. It seemed to be tearing itself apart from the inside.
"Oh, my boy!" Mr. Ross screamed. "Oh, my boy!"
He let go of his wife and fell back against the wall between the two red vinyl chairs. He slid down the wall until he was sitting, hands held out toward the bed, cheeks wet, snot hanging from his nostrils, hair sticking up in the back, shirt tail out, pants pulled up so you could see the tops of his socks. He sat there like that and wailed. His wife knelt by him and took him in her arms as best she could, and that was when the doctor came in with the nurse right behind him, and when David slipped out, crying hard but trying not to sob. They were in a hospital after all, and some people were trying to get well.
"Sorry you had to see that," his father said as they waited for the world's slowest elevator.
David had an idea it was all he could think of to say. On the ride home, Ralph Carver started to speak twice and then stopped. He turned on the radio, found an oldie station, then turned it down to ask David if he wanted an ice cream soda or anything. David shook his head, and his father turned the music up again, louder than ever. When they got home, David told his father he thought he'd shoot some baskets in the driveway. His father said that was fine, then hurried inside. As David stood behind the crack in the hot top that he used as a foul line, he heard his parents in the kitchen, their voices drifting out of the open window over the sink. She wanted to know what had happened, how David had taken it.
"Well, there was a scene," his father said, as though Brian's coma and approaching death were part of some play. David suddenly felt very strongly that he wanted to go down to the Bear Street woods, down to the little clearing. A path, narrow, but you could ride bikes along it if you went single file, led into this clearing. It was here, up in the Viet Cong lookout, that the boys had tried one of Debbie Ross's cigarettes the year before and found it awful. Here that they had hung their feet down and had their long conversations. It was here in the clearing you got to by way of the Ho Chi Minh Trail that the boys had most enjoyed their friendship, and it was here that David suddenly felt he had to go. He walked, head down, the bright blue excused early pass still sticking out of his shirt pocket, although school was over for the day by then. The big yellow buses were rolling their homeward routes. Yelling flocks of little kids pounded past, waving their papers and lunchboxes. David took no notice. His mind was elsewhere. He came to Bear Street, then to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He walked slowly down it, his head still lowered so that he looked like a scholar with his mind on some immense problem. Halfway to the clearing, he spotted a Three Musketeers candy bar wrapper and picked it up. It was the only kind of candy bar Brian would eat. He called them Three Muskies, and David had no doubt that Brian had dropped this one beside the path a day or two before the accident. With no thought of what he was doing, David stuck the red and silver wrapper into his mouth and sucked the little bits of sweet chocolate off the inside. When the chocolate was all gone and there was nothing left but the taste of wet paper, he spat the wrapper out and went on his way. At the east edge of the clearing was an oak with two thick branches spreading out in a V about 20 feet up. The boys hadn't quite dared to go whole hog and build a treehouse in this beckoning fork. Someone might notice and make them tear it down again. But they had brought boards, hammers, and nails down here one summer day a year ago and made a platform that still remained. David went up, cheeks wet, eyes swollen, still tasting chocolate and wet paper in his mouth, still hearing the gasp of the accordion thing in his ears. He felt he would find some other sign of Brian on the platform, like the Three Muskies wrapper on the path, but there was nothing. Just the sign nailed to the tree, the one that said, Viet Cong Lookout, which they had put up a couple of weeks after completing the platform. The inspiration for that, and for the name they'd given the path, was some old movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. David didn't remember the name. A breeze soft through the trees, cooling his hot skin. Any other day, and Brian would have been sharing that breeze with him. They would have been dangling their feet, talking, laughing. David started to cry again. Why am I here? No answer. If anyone's there, please answer. No answer for a long time. And then one did come. And he didn't think he was just talking to himself inside his own head, then fooling himself about what he was doing in order to gain a little comfort. As when he had stood over Brian, the thought which came seemed in no way his own. Yes, this voice had said. I'm here.
Who are you?
Who I am, the voice said, and then fell silent, as if that actually explained something. David crossed his legs, sitting tailor fashion in the middle of the platform, and closed his eyes. He opened his mind as best he could. He had no idea what else to do. In this fashion, he waited for an unknown length of time, hearing the distant voices of the home-going children, aware of moving red and black shapes on the insides of his eyelids as dapples of sunlight slipped back and forth on his face.
"Tell me what you want," he asked the voice.
No answer. The voice didn't seem to want anything. Distant, distant, he heard the sound of the firehouse whistle over on Columbus Broad. It was 5 o'clock. He had been sitting up on the platform with his eyes closed for at least an hour, probably more like two. His mom and dad would have noticed he was no longer in the driveway, would be worried. He loved them and didn't want to worry them, but he couldn't go home yet, because he wasn't done yet.
"Do you want me to pray?" he asked the voice. "I'll try if you want me to, but I don't know how," and
the voice overrode his, not angry, not amused, not impatient, not anything he could read.
"You're praying already," it said. "What should I pray for?"
"Oh, shit, the mummy's after us," the voice said. "Let's all walk a little faster." I don't know what that means.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't.
Yes, I do,
he said, almost moaned.
Yes, I do. It means ask for what none of them dare to ask for. Pray for what none of them dare to pray for. Is that it?
No answer from the voice. David opened his eyes, and the day bombed him with late light, the red-gold glow of October. The day's simple, unzipped loveliness stunned him, and for a moment he was very aware of himself as part of something whole, a cell on the living skin of the world. He lifted his hands from his knees, turned them over, and held them out.
Make him better, he said. God, make him better. If you do, I'll do something for you. I'll listen for what you want, and then I'll do it. I promise.
He didn't close his eyes, but listened carefully, waiting to see if the voice had anything more to say. At first it seemed it did not. He lowered his hands, started to stand up, then winced at the burst of pins and needles that went whooshing up his legs from the balls of his feet. He grabbed a branch to steady himself, and as he was doing this, the voice did speak again. David listened, head cocked, still holding the branch, still feeling his muscles tingle crazily as the blood worked its way back into them. Then he nodded. They had put 3 nails into the trunk of the tree to hold the Viet Cong lookout sign. The wood had shrunk and warped since then, and the rusty heads of the nails stuck out. David took the blue pass with "Excused Early" printed on it from his shirt pocket and poked it onto one of the nail heads. That done, he marched in place until the tingling in his legs began to subside, and he trusted himself to climb back down the tree. He went home. He hadn't even gotten to the driveway before his parents were out the kitchen door.
Where were you? Where in hell were you, David?
I went for a walk into the Bear Street woods. I was thinking about Brian.
Well, you scared the devil out of us, his mom said.
Kirsten joined her on the stoop. She was eating a bowl of Jell-O and had her favorite doll, Melissa Sweetheart, tucked under her arm.
Even Kirsty was worried, weren't you?
Nope,
Pi said, and went on eating her Jell-O.
Are you all right? His father had asked.
Yes.
He went into the house, yanking on one of Pi's braids as he went past her. Pi wrinkled her nose at him, then smiled.
Supper's almost ready. Go wash up, Ellen said.
The telephone started to ring. She went to answer it, then called sharply to David as he headed for the downstairs bathroom to wash his hands. He turned and saw his mom holding out the telephone in one fist while she twisted the other restlessly in her apron.
It's Debbie Ross. For you. She's crying. I think it must be over. For God's sake, be kind to her.
David crossed the room and took the phone. That feeling of otherness had swept over him again. He had been sure his mom was at least half right. Something was over.
Hello? He said. Mrs. Ross?
She was crying so hard that at first she couldn't talk. There was a mighty honk in David's ear. It sounded like a hungry goose, and then she said,
Brian's awake.
Is he? David said. What she had just said made him feel happier than he had ever been in his life, and yet it had not surprised him at all.
Is he dead?
Ellen was mouthing at him. One hand was still plunged deep in her apron, twisting and turning.
No,
David said, putting his hand over the mouthpiece to talk to his mother and father. It was all right. He could do that. Debbie Ross was sobbing again.
Not dead. Alive. She says he's awake.
His mother and father gaped like fish in an aquarium. Pi went past them, still eating Jell-O, her face turned down to the face of her doll, which was sticking stiffly out from the crook of her arm.
Told you this would happen,
she said to Melissa Sweetheart in a forbidding "this closes the discussion" tone of voice.
Didn't I say so?
Awake, David's mother had said in a stunned, musing voice. Alive!
David, are you there?
Mrs. Ross asked.
Yes, he said, right here. About 20 minutes after you left, the EEG monitor started to show waves. I saw them first. Mark was down in the caf getting sodas, and I went to the nurse's station. They didn't believe me.
She laughed through her tears.
And when I finally got someone to come look, they called maintenance instead of a doctor. That's how sure they were that it couldn't be happening. They actually replaced the monitor. Isn't that the most amazing thing you've ever heard?
Yes, David said. Wild. Both parents were mouthing at him now, and his dad was also making big hand gestures. To David, he looked like an insane asylum inmate who thought he was a game show host. That made him want to laugh. He didn't want to do that while he was on the phone. Mrs. Ross wouldn't understand, so he turned and faced the wall.
It wasn't until they saw the same high waves on the new monitor, only even stronger, that one of the nurses called Dr. Wasluski. He's the neurologist. Before he got here, Brian opened his eyes and looked around at us. He asked me if I'd fed the goldfish today, and I said yes. The goldfish were fine, and I didn't cry or anything. I was too stunned to cry. And then he said his head ached and closed his eyes again. When Dr. Wasluski came in, Brian looked like he was still in the coma, and I saw him give the nurse a look like, why do you bother me with this, you know?
Sure, David said.
But when the doctor clapped his hands beside his ear, Brian opened his eyes again right away. You should have seen that old Pollock's face, Davy.
She laughed, the cracked, cackling laugh of a madwoman.
Then Brian said he was thirsty and asked if he could have a drink of water.
She broke down entirely then, her sobs so loud in his ear that they almost hurt. Then they faded, and Bri's dad said,
David, you still there?
He sounded none too steady himself, but he wasn't outright bawling, which was a relief.
Sure. Dr. Wasluski says he's heard of cases like this, but never actually seen one. He called it a clinical miracle. I just want to thank you, David. So does Debbie, from the bottom of our hearts.
Me? David asked. A hand was tugging at his shoulder, trying to get him to turn around. He resisted it.
What are you thanking me for? For bringing Brian back to us. He heard you, Davy. He heard you and came back.
It wasn't me, David said. He turned around. His folks were all but looming over him, their faces frantic with hope, amazement, confusion.
I know what I know, Mr. Ross said. I know what I know, David.
Can I come and see him tomorrow?
Mr. Ross had laughed then.
David, you can come see him at midnight if that's what you want. Why not? Dr. Wasluski says we have to keep waking him up anyway and asking him stupid questions. I know what he's afraid of, that Brian will slip back into the coma, but I don't think that's going to happen, do you?
Nope, David said. Bye, Mr. Ross. He had hung up the telephone then, and his parents all but pounced on him. How did it happen, they wanted to know. How did it happen, and what do they think you had to do with it? David felt an urge then, an amazingly strong one, to cast his eyes down modestly and say, Mr. and Mrs. Ross think he might have heard my voice and responded to it, but you know how upset they've been. That's all it would take to start a legend. Part of him knew it, and he wanted to do it. Part of him really, really wanted to do it. It wasn't the strange inside-out voice that stopped him, but a thought of his own, one that was more intuited than articulated. If you take the credit, it stops here. What stops? Everything that matters, the voice of intuition responded.
David, come on, his father said, giving his shoulders a little shake. We're dying here.
Brian's awake, he said, choosing his words carefully. He can talk. He can remember. The brain guy says it's a miracle. I don't know what happened, and I don't care. He's awake. That's all I care about.
That's all you need to care about, darling, his mother said, and gave him a brief, hard hug.
I'm hungry, he said. What's for supper? Now he hung in the black, blind but not deaf, listening for the voice that one Reverend Jean Martin called the still, small voice of God. Reverend Martin had listened carefully to David's story, not once but many times over the last 10 months, and he seemed especially pleased by David's recounting of how he had felt during the conversation with his parents after he had finished talking with Mr. Ross.
You were completely correct, Reverend Martin had said. It wasn't another voice you heard at the end. Satan tempted you as he tempted Moses. But in this case, you did what Moses didn't or couldn't. First understood, then...
What about Moses? What did he do? Reverend Martin told him the story of how, when the Israelites he'd led out of Egypt were thirsty, Moses had struck a stone with Aaron's staff
and brought water gushing out of it. And when the Israelites asked to whom their thanks should be directed, Moses said they could thank him. Reverend sipped from a teacup with happy, joyous, and free printed on the side as he told this story, but what was in the cup didn't exactly smell like tea to David.
Just one little misstep in a long, hard-working life in the service of the Lord, Reverend Martin said cheerfully. But God kept him out of the promised land for it.
This conversation had taken place on a Sunday afternoon in June. By then, the two of them had known each other for quite a while and grown comfortable with each other. David had fallen into the habit of going to church in the morning and then walking over to the Methodist parsonage on Sunday afternoon and talking with the Reverend Martin for an hour or so in his study. David looked forward to these meetings, and Jean Martin did too. He believed that David Carver had been touched by God, and that God's touch might not yet have departed. He told his wife that David was the only honest convert he had ever seen, and that what had happened to David's friend was the only modern miracle he'd ever heard of that he could actually believe in.
Marvelous, Stella Martin replied. That will be a comfort to me and the baby if your young friend says the wrong thing about his religious instruction and you wind up in court facing child abuse charges. You have to be careful, Jean, and you're crazy to be drinking around him.
I'm not drinking around him, the Reverend Martin had replied, suddenly finding something interesting to look at out the window. At last he had returned his eyes to his wife.
As to the other, the Lord is my shepherd.
He went on seeing David on Sunday afternoons. He didn't quit mixing Seagram's with his tea, a Sunday afternoon tradition of long standing, but he left the study door open whenever he and David were together. The TV was always on during their conversations, always punched to mute and turned to the various Sunday afternoon athletic contests. Soundless football, when David first came to Reverend Martin, then soundless basketball, then soundless baseball. It was during a soundless baseball game between the Indians and the A's that David sat mulling over the story of Moses and the water from the rock. After a while, he looked up from the TV screen and said,
God isn't very forgiving, is he?
Yes, indeed he is, Reverend Martin said, sounding a little surprised. He has to be, because he's so demanding.
But he's cruel, too, isn't he?
Jean Martin hadn't hesitated.
Yes, he said, God is cruel. I have popcorn, David. Would you like me to make some?
Now he floated in the black, listening for Reverend Martin's cruel God, the one who had refused Moses' entry into the land of Goshen because Moses had one single time claimed God's work as his own, the one who had used him in some fashion to save Brian Ross, the one who had then killed his sweet little sister and put the rest of them in the hands of a giant lunatic who had the empty eyes of a coma patient. There were other voices in the dark place where he went when he prayed. Today, one of them was very clear indeed.
If you want to pray, pray to me, it said. Why would you pray to a God who kills baby sisters? She's dead, and you and your folks are in jail. When he comes back, the crazy cop, he'll probably kill all of you. What else would you expect from a God who kills baby sisters? He's as crazy as the cop when you get right down to cases. Come on, Davy, get a life. Get a grip. Pray to me. At least I'm not crazy.
He wasn't rocked by this voice. Not very, anyway. He'd heard it before, perhaps first wrapped inside that strong impulse to give his folks the impression that he had called Brian back from the deep reaches of his coma. When he told Reverend Martin about how that voice would sometimes cut in as if it was on a telephone extension, Reverend Martin had only laughed.
Like God, Satan tends to speak to us most clearly in our prayers and meditations, he said. It's when we're most open.
He had taught David a little mantra to use at such times, and he used it now. See in me, be in me, he thought, over and over again. Distant, the howl of a coyote. Then, nothing. He waited, trying to stay open, and still there was nothing. At last he gave up and spoke the prayer-ending words that Reverend Martin had taught him, muttering them into his clasped hands.
Lord, make me be useful to myself and help me to remember that until I am, I can't be useful to others. Make me a vessel which is whole to your service. Thanks. Amen.
He opened his eyes. As always, he first stared into the darkness in the center of his clasped hands, and as always, the first thing it reminded him of was an eye. A hole like an eye. Whose, though? God's?
The devil's? Perhaps just his own? He stood up, turned slowly around, looked at his parents. They were looking back at him. Ellie amazed. Ralph grave. Well, thank heaven, his mother said. She gave him a chance to reply, and when he didn't, she asked, Were you praying? Yes. Is this a recent development, or have you been doing it since you started going to that church? She was still looking at him with a perplexity that made David feel self-conscious. He's been doing it since Brian's accident, Ralph said. He stared at David through two sets of bars, looking as self-conscious as David felt. I came upstairs to kiss you goodnight this one time. It was a few days after they let Brian go home, and I saw you down on your knees at the foot of your bed. At first I thought you might be, well, I don't know, doing something else, and then I heard some of what you were saying and understood. David smiled, feeling a blush heat his cheeks. I do it in my head now. I don't even move my lips. Maybe he understands, but I don't, Ellen said. I talk to God, he said. This was embarrassing, but maybe if it was said once and right out straight, it wouldn't have to be said again. Does God answer? Sometimes I think I hear him, David said. He reached into his pocket and touched the shotgun shell with the tips of his fingers. And once I know I did, I asked him to let Brian be all right. After Dad took me to the hospital, I went to the Bear Street Woods and climbed to the platform me and Brian made in a tree there and asked God to let him be all right. I said that if he did that, I kind of give him an IOU. Do you know what I mean? Yes, David, I know what an IOU is. Has he collected on it? What kind of deal did he make with you, this wonderful God? Was it like one of the baseball card trades you do with your buds? Did he say, hey, I'll trade you this neat Brian Ross 84 for this Kirsty Carver 88? Was it like that? Or more like, lady, he's your boy, and I don't mean to interfere, but why don't you give it a rest? I guess you lost your little girl. I lost my husband. We've all had a tough day. It was the woman who had shot at the cop. She was sitting on the end of the bunk. Her black hair hung against her cheeks like limp wings, but did not obscure her face. She looked shocked and stricken and tired. He thought for a moment that his mother would turn her rage on the dark-haired woman, but something in the dark-haired woman's face, Mary, he thought, her name is Mary, changed his mother's mind, if blowing up had indeed been on it. She focused on David again instead. So, any word from the big G on how we're supposed to get out of this? You were on your knees long enough. There must have been some sort of message. No, David said. No message. Someone's coming, Mary said sharply. David heard it too. An approaching motor. The man with the white hair was sitting at the foot of the cell's bunk, his hands pressed together finger to finger between his thighs. He talked without raising his eyes from his hands. Don't get your hopes up. Ain't nobody but him. I recognize the sound of the motor. And as David turned to look at the old man, the still, small voice, the one he had heard first in Brian's hospital room, spoke to him. As usual, its arrival came pretty much as a surprise, and the two words it spoke made no immediate sense. The soap. He looked into the left rear corner of the cell he was sharing with old Mr. Whitehair. There was a toilet with no seat. Beside it was an ancient, rust-stained porcelain sink. Sitting beside the right-hand spigot was a green bar of what could only be Irish Spring soap. Outside, the engine sound of the Desperation police cruiser grew fatter and closer. A little further off, the coyotes howled. To David, that howling had begun to sound like the laughter of lunatics after the keepers have decamped the asylum. The Carver family had been too distraught and too focused on their captor to notice the dead dog hung from the Welcome to Town sign, but John Marinville was a trained noticer, and in truth, the dog was now hard to miss. Since the Carvers had passed this way, the buzzards had found it. They sat on the ground below the carcass, the ugliest birds Johnny had ever seen, one pulling on old Shep's tail, the other gnawing at one of his dangling feet. "Buzzards!" the cop said.
Gosh, aren't they something?
His voice had thickened a great deal. He had sneezed twice more on the ride in from town, and the second time there had been teeth in the blood he sprayed out of his mouth. Johnny didn't know what was happening to him and didn't care. He only wished it would hurry up. "Where are you taking me?" Johnny asked, striving for a neutral tone.
"Jail,"
the big cop said in his stuffy, liquid voice.
"Where anything you bray will be abused against you in a sort of caw."
He leaned forward, wincing at the pain in his back where the cop had kicked him. "You need help," he said. He tried to keep his voice non-accusatory, even gentle. "Do you know that, officer?"
"You're the one who needs help," the cop replied. "Spiritual, physical, and editorial. Talk! But no help is going to come, Johnny. You're on your own in the wilderness, and this is going to be the longest 40 days and 40 nights of your long and useless life."
The words rang in his head like the peal of some sickly bell. Johnny closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them again. There was nobody on the sidewalks. Absolutely nobody. He'd never seen a small western town that was actually bustling, but this was ridiculous. No one at all, except up ahead. A pair of animals went trotting lazily across what appeared to be the town's only intersection, moving on a diagonal beneath the blinker light. Johnny tried to tell himself they were dogs, but they weren't dogs. They were coyotes. "It's not all the cop, Johnny. Don't you think it is? Something not normal is going on here. Something very much not normal." The cop turned right, then almost immediately hung a left, turning into a parking lot next to the town's municipal building. He killed the engine, got out, and opened the right-hand rear door. Johnny got out. He was very aware of the silence. The sounds he could hear, wind, the spick-spack of alkali hitting the brick side of the municipal building, a monotonous squeaking sound from somewhere nearby, only emphasized that silence, turned it into something like a dome. He forced himself to look up into the ruin of the cop's face. The man's height was intimidating, somehow disorienting. He didn't just stand, he loomed. "Why don't you just kill me? Or does it even make any sense to ask? Are you beyond why?" "Oh, we're all beyond why. You know that," the cop said, exposing bloody teeth in a smile Johnny could have done without. "The important thing is, listen closely. I could let you go. Would you like that?" "Yes, I'd like that very much." Not that he believed his new playmate had the slightest intention in the world of letting him free. Oh, no. But said playmate was shortly going to be nothing but blood sausage held together by the casing of his uniform, and if he could just remain whole and functional himself until that happened. "All right, here's the deal, big shot. Suck my cock. Do that, and I'll let you go. Straight trade." He unzipped his fly and pulled down the elastic front of his shorts. Something that looked like a dead white snake fell out. Johnny observed the thin stream of blood drizzling from it without surprise. The cop was bleeding from every other orifice, wasn't he?
"Speaking in the literary sense," the cop said, grinning, "this particular blowjob is going to be a little more Anne Rice than Armistead Maupin. I suggest you follow Queen Victoria's advice. Close your eyes and think of strawberry shortcake."
Johnny Merrinville looked at the maniac's prick, then up at the maniac's grinning face, then back down at his prick again. "I'll get down on my knees in front of you if you want," he said, and although his voice was mild, something in the cop's face changed, really changed for the first time. It blanked out somehow, except for the good eye, which narrowed suspiciously.
"Why are you looking at me that way? What in hell gives you the right to look at me that way? Talk!"
"Never mind how I'm looking at you. Just hear me out, motherfucker. 3 seconds after I put that trouser rat of yours into my mouth, it's going to be lying on the pavement. You got that? Talk!" He spat this last word up into the cop's face, standing on tiptoe to do it, and for a moment, the big man looked more than surprised. He looked shocked. Then the expression tightened into a cramp of rage, and he shoved Johnny away from him so hard that for a moment he felt as if he were flying. He hit the side of the building, saw stars as the back of his head connected with rough brick, bounced back, then went sprawling when his feet tangled together. New places hurt, and old places howled. but the expression he had seen on the cop's face made it all worthwhile. He looked up to see if it was still there, wanting to sample it again like a bee sampling the sweetheart of a flower, and his heart staggered in his chest. The cop's face had tautened. The skin on it now looked like makeup or a thin coat of paint. Unreal. It was as if there was another face beneath the one Johnny could see, pushing at the overlying flesh, trying to get out. The cop's good eye fixed on him for a moment, and then his head lifted. He pointed at the sky with all four fingers of his left hand.
"Doc Allah," he said in his guttural, gargling voice. "Timo, Kandalak, on, on."
There was a flapping sound, like clothes on a line, and a shadow fell over Johnny's face. There was a harsh cry, not quite a caw, and then something with scabrous flapping wings dropped on him, its crooked claws gripping his shoulders and folding themselves into the fabric of his shirt, its beak digging into his scalp as it uttered its inhuman cry again. It was the smell that told Johnny what it was, a smell like meat gone feverish with rot. Its huge, unkempt wings flapped against the sides of his face as it solidified its position, driving that stench into his mouth and nose, jamming it in, making him gag. He saw the shepherd on its rope, swinging as the peeled-looking ball things pulled at its tail and feet with their beaks. Now one of them was roosting on him, and its beak was plowing his scalp in furrows, bringing blood. "Get it off!" he screamed, completely unnerved. He tried to grab the wide, beating wings, but got only two fistfuls of feathers. "Jesus, please, please, get it off me!"
"Fuck you," the cop said calmly. "Take care of it yourself, or die."
Eyes squeezed shut, kneeling, head lowered, Johnny groped blindly for the bird, caught its wings where they joined its body, and tore it off his head. It spasmed wildly in the air above him, shitting white streams that the wind pulled away in banners, uttering its rough cry, its head whipping from side to side. Sobbing, Johnny ripped one of its wings off and threw the buzzard against the wall. It stared at him with eyes as black as tar, its blood-stained beak popping open and then snapping closed with liquid little clicks.
"That's my blood, you bastard," Johnny thought.
He dropped the wing he'd torn off the bird and got to his feet. The buzzard tried to lurch away from him, flapping its one good wing like an oar, stirring up dust and feathers. Before it managed more than 5 feet, Johnny brought one motorcycle boot down on it, snapping its back. The bird's scaly legs splayed out to either side, as if it was trying to do the splits. Johnny put his hands over his eyes, convinced for one moment that his mind was going to snap just as the bird's back had snapped.
"Not bad," the cop said. "You got him, pard. Now turn around."
There was no denying the voice. He turned and saw the cop pointing up. Johnny raised his head and saw more buzzards, 2 dozen at least, sitting in a line along the north side of the parking lot, looking down at them.
"Want me to call 'em?"
the cop asked in a deceptively gentle tone of voice.
"I can, you know. They'll eat you alive, if that's what I want."
No. He looked back at the cop and was relieved to see his fly was zipped again. There was a bloodstain spreading across the front of his pants, though.
"No, don't." "What's the magic word, Johnny?"
For a moment, a horrible moment, he had no idea what the cop wanted him to say. Then it came to him.
"Please, are you ready to be reasonable?"
"Yes."
"I wonder about that," the cop said.
He seemed to be speaking to himself.
"I just wonder. Maybe I should just kill you, Johnny. Maybe it would be the best thing. Once you're dead, they might award you that Nobel you've always lusted after. What do you think?"
The cop raised his head to the buzzard-lined roofline of the municipal building and began to laugh. They cried harsh cawing sounds back down at him, and Johnny was not able to stifle the thought which came to him then. It was horrible because it was so convincing. They are laughing with him because it's not his joke, it's their joke. A gust of air snapped across the parking lot, making Johnny stagger on his feet, blowing the torn-off buzzard wing across the pavement like a feather duster. The light was fading out of the day, fading too fast. He looked to the west and saw that rising dust had blurred the mountains in that direction and might soon erase them completely. It was a windstorm and headed their way.